loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we go to Helsinki to the summit between President Donald Trump and President Putin. They met for several hours and held a press conference afterwards. They talked about Syria, Iran, nuclear proliferation, the 2016 U.S. elections, and alleged Russian election interference, and more. We're going to talk about it and what comes next with U.S.-Russian relations. And then it's our Monday segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa. Every Monday, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We talk today about how GPS can track you even if it's off, Twitter's metadata haul, and today's technology tip is about keeping your devices secure. Stay tuned.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump wraps up his European trip today, with the last stop being Helsinki. He called the European Union a foe, told British Prime Minister May to sue the EU. He said Boris Johnson would make a great prime minister of the UK, and he weighed in on the Nord Stream pipeline that will pipe Russian gas to Germany much more cheaply than any US alternative. Next, police in Chicago shot and killed a man on Saturday when he appeared to be reaching for a gun. Protests across the city became heated on Saturday night, and today the police released two body cam videos of the incident to try to calm the public. Then we continue our series called Stories from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where Dr. Alice Bonner highlights some of the most important episodes in Black history. Today she focuses on John Brown's rebellion in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. And then the White House yesterday ordered the State Department to seek direct negotiations with the Taliban in the hope of jumpstarting efforts to end the 17-year war there. The Taliban have said that they will only deal with the United States, but President Trump insists that the Afghan government also take part. And finally, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, where we look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, today is Prime Day, a big day for Amazon sales, and Amazon workers in Germany and Spain are striking to demand labor contracts with healthy working conditions for those in the fulfillment centers. German workers are on a one-day strike, while Spanish workers are out for 3 days. But Amazon has reassured customers that there will be no impact on Prime Day deliveries. Sinclair Broadcasting's proposed $3.9 billion purchase of Tribune Media may be in danger, as Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai says he has serious concerns. Pai has also called for an administrative hearing, which a former FCC aide noted means the deal, quote, is not going to survive, unquote. Sinclair is the top television broadcast group in the country with 192 stations. Tribune Media has 42. As families are being reunited after crossing the U.S. border and being torn apart, the ACLU is suing to allow them a one-week period to decide whether to be deported as a family or to allow the children to stay and seek asylum. The ACLU has reported persistent and increasing rumors of quick deportation. Argentina has captured former Chilean Army Colonel Sergio Francisco Jara Arancibia, who committed murders and terror under dictator Augusto Pinochet. Pinochet was installed in a U.S.-backed coup in 1973 that overthrew the democratically elected socialist Popular Unity government of President Salvador Allende. Jara Arancibia will be extradited to Chile, where he's already been convicted of murder by Chile's Supreme Court. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to the Helsinki summit. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of The Plot, The Scapegoat, Russia, and other books. And we're joined by Max Blumenthal. He's a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. And we're joined from Helsinki, Finland by Lee Stranahan. Lee is covering the summit for Sputnik. Welcome to all of you.
Good to be
Thank
on.
You. Thank you.
Thank you for joining. Let's start with an audio clip. This is Donald Trump. He spoke right after Putin spoke at a press conference following this two-hour-long meeting. Trump right now, as we all know, is getting hammered in the U.S. media for kind of being on Russia's team instead of Team America, for having had the summit and for saying that he still didn't believe in the witch hunt, what he calls the Mueller witch hunt, the rigged witch hunt, in his words. Let's listen to Trump, and then I'll get your reactions.
As president, I cannot make decisions on foreign policy in a futile effort to appease partisan critics or the media or Democrats who want to do nothing but resist and obstruct. Constructive dialogue between the United States and Russia affords the opportunity to open new pathways toward peace and stability in our world. I would rather take a political risk in pursuit of peace than to risk peace in pursuit of politics.
All right. So, Max Blumenthal, let's start with you. I know you may not be on with us for the entire segment. Anyway, you can be against Donald Trump. I certainly am. I'm organizing against Donald Trump all the time on so many different issues. But he's being hammered right now. That sounded like a fairly reasonable statement on his part, because, of course, it would have been very easy not to have this meeting. And he will, predictably, and he is being hammered just for talking to Putin, even though Obama talked to Putin, George W. Bush talked to Putin. Every U.S. president since Roosevelt has been talking to either the Soviet leadership or the Russian leadership. Anyway, what's your take?
Well, I expected to see the reactions that I'm seeing right now from figures like former CIA Director John Brennan, who has accused Trump of high crimes and treason. The penalty is death for that if you're convicted. Because of the timing of the release of Mueller's indictment, Rod Rosenstein deliberately timed it to trigger this kind of freak out from the press and to completely sabotage this summit. The indictment was prepared. It was all ready on March 1st of this year, and that was reported by Meet the Press and Chuck Todd. So for 4 months, he held it and waited for this moment to release it to produce this spasm of condemnation and really absurd levels of American exceptionalism. I just saw Richard Haass talk about how, the world order that Trump is rejecting has been previously predicated on non-interference in sovereign countries' affairs. Yeah, the U.S. never interfered in another country's affair. So I'm not surprised by this freak out. I think, it would have taken place, but with less confidence and at lower volume, if Mueller hadn't timed the indictment release for last Friday. Trump has also been extremely sloppy in the way that he's approached the summit. He was asked what his goal was, and he said, "I'll tell you after the summit." And he should have made clear that his goal was to discuss Syria and laid out the issues in front of him and Putin. But here's what's going on and what the American press pool, which behaved in such a clueless and predictable manner today, doesn't understand. And that's that American empire is fraying. The U.S., Israel, Jordan, and pretty much everyone in the region has had to turn to Russia as a major player in Syria. And Israel needs Russia to, in its view, keep Iranian proxy forces away from the Golan and keep Iran's presence in Syria limited. Everyone's had to turn to Syria. The U.S. wants a way out of Syria. Its troops shouldn't be there. Trump doesn't want them there, so it's had to turn to Russia. Russia's playing a major role on the world stage, and there's nothing that any Democrat opponent of Trump can do about that. I saw Elizabeth Warren also accuse Trump of some form of treason, but the fact is, when Elizabeth Warren, if she gets into the White House, she will have to conduct high-level meetings with Russia to discuss these serious issues, and that really just reflects where America's place in the world is right now. The empire is fraying.
Lee Stranahan, let's go to you. You're in Helsinki. This talk, this meeting may have been maybe primarily, at least in terms of content, about Syria, just as Max Blumenthal is suggesting. Russian and their U.S. military counterparts, including Dunford, the head of the Joint Chiefs, they've been meeting routinely. And American colonels and Russian colonels are talking as much as 10 to 15 times a day about the Syria situation. What's your take in terms of Syria here?
Well, first off, I pretty much agree with everything Max said. I went to Beirut in 2013 to do reporting on the Syrian refugee crisis and the growth of the Salafi forces. And I have been saying for over a year now that I thought that the demonization of Russia, a lot of it was about Syria. That if the American people knew how their tax dollars were being used to back Salafi forces and to slaughter people, including Christians, but also Alawite Muslims, Shia in general. But if the American people knew that, they would be opposed to it. And I have been, as a Trump supporter, I believe he wanted to get out of Syria. But you notice every time he's tried to, it ends up, you know, there's suddenly a gas attack in Douma or something like that. These false flag attacks keep coming up. This is the desperation of the establishment. And so I wasn't surprised by the freak out either. One other minor point on the Mueller indictment. I'm peripherally mentioned in the Mueller indictment. I'm the reporter who on August 22nd was in contact with Guccifer too. I will point out that no one from Mueller's team has ever attempted to contact me. I've not heard from anybody at the FBI, which is part of the reason I know it's a completely shoddy investigation. Because if you're going to mention me, at least try to get the files from me to do some forensics information. They've never contacted me in any way. And I've been very open about the fact that I talked to Guccifer too. So I thought it was a pretty stunning moment of Donald Trump taking on the deep state, the CIA, the FBI, the military industrial complex, as much as he's able to within the confines he's working with. He's still an ally of Israel. All of that still remains. But as much as within those confines, I thought it was pretty stunning what he did today.
And Dan Kilavalik, you know, when George W. Bush was president, he said he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and he could see his soul and he liked him. President Obama, when he came into office, he sent Hillary Clinton with that big red button, poorly translated, that said, let's have a reset. These were considered normal things. What accounts for the fact that the United States government or the U.S. media and the Democrats and Republicans, both parties right now are hammering Trump? And again, we're not, you know, Lee is a supporter of Trump. Certainly I'm not, and John is not. But they're hammering Trump because he's doing what previous presidents also said they wanted to do, which was to improve relations. And Putin said he preferred Trump because he was the only one during the campaign who said he wanted better relations with Russia. What accounts for the change?
Well, for some time, Putin and Russia have been verboten. And there's a number of reasons that is so. I think in large part because Putin helped Russia get back on its feet after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the neoliberal disaster under Yeltsin, which, of course, Clinton helped to cultivate. And they are concerned about the fact that Russia does have a presence and a very productive one on the world stage. I think the U.S. does not want any competitors in the world. It wants to be the only superpower. It sees Russia as possibly being able to compete with it, at least in some regions of the world. And therefore, it's been time to vilify Russia and Vladimir Putin. And both the Democratic Party and the intelligence community made it clear that, especially once Trump was elected, that they would not allow him to reset relations with Russia and Vladimir Putin. But he has done that, and I welcome that. I've always thought that that was the right thing to do. The fact that Trump is doing it doesn't make it wrong. As they say, a broken clock is right twice a day, and this is one time he's right.
Max, I was listening to Christine Amanpour on CNN earlier today, and she was explaining why relations have become bad. And she said there were two reasons. One, Putin became head of state in 2000. That was number one. And number two, Putin invaded other countries, which we all know to be wrong. I'm paraphrasing, but it's almost, I mean, I was like, what? Anyway. And then you have, so that's Christine Amanpour, who predictably talking like that. But I want to read to you, Max, John Brennan, former CIA director, what he said. Actually, Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, he is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you? I mean, that sounds like a call to arms. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I was referring to. Christiane Amanpour might have a role to play in deepening the conflict with Russia for drumming up the NATO destruction of Yugoslavia. But that's another issue. I mean, the U.S. media has been serially misinforming, deliberately so, about how Russian and U.S. relations have gotten to the state they're in. One thing they won't tell you is that Vladimir Putin was a very welcomed figure on the pages of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal's op-ed sections in 2000. He had replaced someone who was seen was completely unstable, an alcoholic, Boris Yeltsin, who was a Western vassal, and they thought that Putin would do the same. Then Putin started prosecuting oligarchs. One figure who was pumping up Putin in U.S. media was Bill Browder, who is a former American defector who left the U.S. in order to avoid paying taxes, went to Russia with Hermitage Capital as a vulture capitalist, made hundreds of millions of dollars, then tried to avoid taxes in Russia, and is now touted in Western media as this great hero simply because he fights Putin. It doesn't matter that he's a gigantic con artist who has had to physically flee from subpoenas to avoid telling his story under oath. And Bill Browder's personal fortune is responsible for Congress passing by a vote of 99-0 the Magnitsky Act, which was also a major factor sanctioning key figures in Putin's inner circle and in Russia in this conflict that the U.S. has with Russia in igniting a new Cold War. Bill Browder was mentioned at Helsinki by Vladimir Putin when Putin offered reciprocity and offered Robert Mueller's team the ability to question the GRU military intelligence agents who were named in his indictment as responsible for hacking the DNC on the condition that Putin's security services would be allowed to question Bill Browder and American officials who interfered in Russia's internal political process. Obviously, Mueller's not going to go along with this. It's being laughed at by the U.S., but I know that reporters in Helsinki are having to Google and figure out who Bill Browder is, and Bill Browder's name was trending on Twitter, and other reporters are talking about what a hero he is for taking on Putin. He has a best-selling book on his fight against Putin. None of them know that Bill Browder is a gigantic fraud and a tax cheat who gave up U.S. citizenship like a traitor in order to avoid paying taxes. And, you know, it's about time that Bill Browder faces some scrutiny for using his personal fortune and lies to help get us into another Cold War. Beyond that, the reactions are not just from John Brennan. I'm seeing liberals who have been affiliated with social movements talking about how the NATO and the post-World War II alliance are fraying. This American exceptionalism is so deeply embedded in liberal America that there's no discussion or understanding of the danger of a new Cold War and how it will heighten domestic repression and actually harm the left. And that's a discussion that we need to have. But anyone who tries to start that discussion, whether it's Glenn Greenwald or even me, gets called a traitor these days.
Indeed, that's the nature of it. You know, there's breaking news, by the way. We had the breaking news that right before this summit, that the announcement by Mueller, by Rosenstein, of the 12 Russian GRU agents who were indicted. Right now, I'm reading from the Department of Justice website, the court filings detail the Russian officials and Maria Butina's efforts for Butina to act as an agent of Russia. This person, Maria Butina, has just been arrested to act as an agent of Russia inside the United States by developing relationships with U.S. persons and infiltrating organizations having influence in American politics for the purpose of advancing the interests of the Russian Federation. Now, we'll find out more about this, Lee Stranahan.
Well, we do know, actually, that the organization she was directed to infiltrate, according to the Justice Department, is the NRA. And she actually was able to make inroads into the NRA and was invited to ring the NRA's Liberty Bell to kick off their workday. She was supposed to be, her cover job apparently was to create a new relationship between the NRA and the group that she heads in Russia, that is sort of an NRA equivalent, which is kind of funny to me because she just turned 29 years old. And she's not really been around very long.
Let's talk about timing, Lee. I mean, this, again, this dramatic arrest that's taking place this afternoon as we're speaking, you know, it can't, I mean, the timing has to be designed to sort of influence the public perception as Trump is saying, let's have better relations. We are going to have better relations with Russia, but here's this thing has happened.
Well, I don't think this is too much of a stretch. You know, we've had the situation where you see people arrested for driving while black, right? That's a thing that's happened if you're an African-American in this country. Now what we're seeing is politicking while Russian. And the reason I say that is because we've had statements by Clapper as well as by Strzok that can only be described as racist. James Clapper, former DNI, talked about Russians' genetic propensity. Now, you couldn't say that. There's literally, I cannot think of another nationality you could say that about without everyone going, well, that's the most racist thing I've ever heard. Then you had Strzok saying he hates the mother effing Russians and talking about them as savages. And once again, I don't think you could have that anywhere else. And so what's happened is we've been able to, in just two, I remember the halcyon good old days of 2015 when people did not talk about Russians that way. And people, you know, wonder, well, you know, can it happen here? What, you know, saw the rise of Hitler, where Jews were demonized very quickly. Well, we're seeing that with Russians. And the fact is, nobody is going to step up and say, wait, who is this woman? What did she do wrong? She was involved in a political, wait, what? I mean, she wasn't hiding. She wasn't pretending to do something else. But this is another politically motivated indictment. And I got to say, once again, I've been talking about Bill Browder for so long that hearing Max Blumenthal talk about it and doing a great job of summing it up, he's exactly right. The other person I'd put into the mix that came up today is George Soros. And I'll just quickly say this. If you want to understand why there is no organized anti-war movement in this country, you have to look at who Soros was writing checks to. And that includes every major group on the left, mainstream groups like the ACLU and the NAACP.
I have to tell you, Lee, none of the groups I work with got any check from George Soros. It must be other parts of the left.
It's the non-left left group.
The non-left left.
Yeah, but the Move On and that kind of groups.
Democratic Party.
The Atlantic Council. Yep, that's right.
Yeah, gotcha.
And so that's why there's no organization.
Let's hear another audio clip. I want to get a couple more of these in if we can. And then, Dan, let's go next to you. And again, it's along the same theme that Max and Lee are talking about regarding the investigation from Mueller and also the issue of Browder. Let's listen. This is Vladimir Putin.
We can actually permit official representatives of the United States, including the members of this very commission headed by Mr. Mueller, we can let them into the country and they will be present at this questioning. But in this case, there is another condition. And this kind of effort should be a mutual one. Then we would expect that the Americans would reciprocate and they would question officials, including the officers of law enforcement and intelligence services of the United States, whom we believe who have something to do with illegal actions on the territory of Russia. And we have to request the presence of our law enforcement.
Okay, so Dan, just again, I'm going to frame it for the audience. What Putin is basically saying there is, yes, and we've talked about this earlier in the segment, Mueller is invited now to send U.S. intelligence agents to Russia to be able to provide evidence to the Russian government. And in turn, the Russian government would like to do this with others who they suspect of having committed illegal acts on Russian territory, in this case, Mr. Browder. Anyway, that seems like a reasonable offer. They have a treaty. They have an extradition treaty. So there are actual ways that if the two governments wanted to explore possible criminal conduct by either or by citizens of either country, they actually have a process that's in place.
Yeah, well, that's more than a reasonable offer. And Mueller should take Putin up on that, though I'm certain he will not, because I have grave doubts as to whether Mueller really wants to get to the truth, to the bottom of all these things, and is more interested in, frankly, derailing U.S.-Russian relations. But I think, of course, it's appropriate for the two countries to exchange intelligence and information on these types of issues. Russia offered to do the same thing with Great Britain, with the Skripal case, which has fallen apart, and that's a whole other thing. But of course, the U.S. should take Russia up on that offer, but I don't think you'll be seeing that anytime soon.
Max, I saw one of your tweets in the last couple days, actually, where you were like reminding people that Mueller really wouldn't want to have a trial, as they seem to not want to have the trial with the Internet Research Agency, the trolling farm in St. Petersburg. They didn't expect any of the defendants to show up in court, but one of them have, and it seemed like Mueller actually freaked out.
Yeah, it was the Condor Associates, which is the holding company or the LLC that was used by the Internet Research Agency, the Russian troll farm, and they were indicted. I remember watching Rachel Maddow virtually break out in tears, claiming vindication when this Russian troll farm was indicted. Most of its ads were taken out after the election, and most had nothing to do with Hillary Clinton. But Maddow she got misty-eyed, and she said, unfortunately, these Russian trolls, they won't want to show up in court. They're never going to show up in court. Well, they did show up in court and really called Mueller's bluff, because Mueller's indictment was a indictment designed for public relations. It was playing to people like Maddow.
That's right.
And those who want to extend the investigation. And when they showed up in court, what did Mueller do? First, he tried to delay their hearing, rejecting their right to a speedy trial. And then he passed on the case to prosecutors because he has refused to hand over something like 10 million pages of unclassified documents. Unclassified.
Discovery, which they are entitled to receive immediately.
Yes. And so he's rejected discovery because he doesn't want to reveal his sources and methods. And he might want to not reveal some other incriminating information that might even suggest that there's prosecutorial overreach or even fabrication. Prosecutors have been known to fabricate quotes. So I would like to know more about the sources and methods that went into the most recent indictment. I would like to know what his sources and methods were. I think Dutch intelligence might be one. But we'll probably never find out about that, because there's no way Mueller will accept Putin's offer.
Yeah, Lee Stranahan, 1 minute left. I'm looking at the Time magazine cover with, it's a picture of Boris Yeltsin. He has an American flag. Exclusive, Yanks to the Rescue, the secret story of how American advisors helped Yeltsin win. It's kind of interesting that this story, which is like anybody who was following stuff back then in 1996, the U.S. directly intervened to make sure that Yeltsin would remain president of Russia. But here you have, and the U.S. has done this in so many countries, and when the elections don't go the way the U.S. wants them to do, they've carried out coup d'etats in Guatemala or in Iran, many other places. And yet, you know, the American media is just like breathless right now. Trump is collaborating with Putin, and Putin has just brought America to its knees. I mean, the whole thing is so out of proportion. 30 seconds left. You get the last word.
Sure. Well, I mean, look, the history of the CIA, the very first operation, as John Kiriakou and I have talked about, was interfering in the Italian elections and spending a lot of money on ads. They didn't have Italian Facebook in 1948, but it was the equivalent of spending millions of dollars. And that is why John Brennan is freaking out. People in the CIA realize, I think, that if this keeps going, the gig is going to be up for them, that the truth is going to come out about what the U.S. is doing, and that's what they don't want anyone to know.
All right, we're going to leave it there. That was Lee Stranahan. He's covering the summit for Sputnik. We were also joined by author and journalist Max Blumenthal. Max is the author, best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He's also, along with Dan Cohen, made the movie Killing Gaza. And we were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. Dan is a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules, with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, as we are every Monday, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, happy Monday, guys. Good to be back.
Thank you. John and I were just talking. You were in court on Friday. What happened?
Yeah, a few weeks ago, I was at a protest against a restaurant that harbors a known neo-Nazi and actually defends him. And I was arrested because I made a complaint that I was assaulted by one of the restaurant's employees. So the police actually arrested me instead of the employee that assaulted me.
Of course they did.
We have a Thursday segment that's about criminal injustice and how people's rights are denied and how there's so much abuse. Chris Garaffa, you should be on that segment as well. I'm sorry to hear that. So what happened? What are you have a trial coming up?
You know, I just went to court for the first time, actually. Haven't even entered a plea yet, but I'm going to be fighting this case all the way.
Good.
It's a very minor charge. Honestly, it's a breach of the peace, but it's complete retaliation from the police. So I'm not going to take any kind of deal from them.
All right. So we have a micro look at the national surveillance state in terms of what's been happening with Chris. Chris, let's talk about some of the big stories. Let's get us started for this week. Go ahead.
You know, I wanted to talk about this report from The Atlantic. There's a story, people might have actually seen this on Twitter or on Facebook last week. The title in The Atlantic is Unidentified Plain Bay Women's Statement Confirms the Worst. The story behind this is that some folks were on a plane. A woman asked another woman to switch seats so that she could sit with her husband. So this unidentified woman sat with a man she didn't know. In the row behind them, this woman and her husband were sitting. And apparently the two people in the front row kind of, struck up a conversation and got friendly with each other and chatted the whole flight. The woman behind them tweeted the whole thing on Twitter.
Oh, my.
Really great, gross violation of personal privacy. And, of course, the woman and man in front had no idea that this was happening. The problem then became that after people started seeing this on Twitter, some internet detectives took it upon themselves to identify the woman and the man. Now, the woman has asked to remain unidentified. Her name is out there, but I'm going to keep it, I'm going to respect her wishes because there's no reason that people should have gone out and found her name, her occupation, her employer, all of those kind of things. It's really this gross violation of privacy that we all need to be aware of. Now, at first, it seemed like this great love story that these two people, these strangers flying to Dallas, were really hitting it off. But it's really voyeurism at its worst.
Yeah.
To post that all over the internet without somebody's knowledge. And it's really, she's had to shut down social media accounts. She's had to change her work schedule and is constantly getting harassed. Harassment not just from the, oh, I'm so happy for you two, but also people just these awful trolls just being nasty as people are when they're anonymous online. So I thought this was, this isn't about the surveillance state, but it's still about our privacy online. And I would just encourage people, you might see something cute, but consider what damage you could do when you go and post something like this online that the other people aren't even aware of.
Yeah, it's the technology culture. So we're looking at the technology state. We're looking at the abuse of new technologies by mega corporations. But there's also the culture whereby individual, the right to privacy being sort of scuttled in popular culture. I think I'm glad you raised it. And again, you know, it's sad that people would be having to look over their shoulder at every moment now to see whether you're being recorded or you're being transcribed or whatever. But in fact, people do have to be mindful of that, especially if you're involved in, well, in this case, it was a private conversation. But again, if people are going to political demonstrations or they're going to political meetings, they have to be aware that somebody could be, in fact, recording them. It's a big issue, actually. Everybody has to sort of think about it now.
Yeah, can you imagine now having to go through life thinking that at any given moment you may be under some kind of surveillance that could actually impact your life? We all know NSA is watching us and the FBI and whomever else.
Wait, you just gave up your presumption of privacy, John, by saying we know.
True. But now you have to worry about the idiot sitting next to you on the bus or the train or the plane recording your every word and then using it against you. For what reason? Just for fun.
Well, that's the thing, too. I mean, there should be, you know, the way we function is, this is really off track for technology, but since we're here, let's stay with it for a moment. The way we are with each other is based on habit and based on the way we are socialized.
Yes.
And in other words, it's not because there's a police, somebody with a guard with a gun next to you at all times. You are the way you are because of the way we function as human beings, how we are socialized and what our habits are. And it's important, Chris, that because we are in this kind of free market, you know, individualism above all else kind of society, the social rules around what's acceptable with technology, well, there are social rules, but it's not adhered to. And it certainly there's not a lot of education done about it. The way we learn everything as humans, we learn it because we're educated to be a particular way. That's a missing field here, I'd say.
And I would agree with that. I think there's a generational gap as well. I understand that some schools now, down to elementary schools, have in their curriculums some sort of digital privacy. You know, if you post something online, it's there forever, which is true. And that's great, but there's an entire generation, which I belong to, that grew up online as things were still really being formed, as what it meant to live your life online was undefined because we were defining it ourselves. And, you know, we didn't have that experience. You know, I think that probably not by 2020, but certainly by 2024 or 2028, we're going to see not just current tweets being referred to for presidential elections, but historical tweets and Facebook posts and Instagram stories being brought up in the context of political elections. And that's, you know, who knows what somebody said 10, 15 years ago is going to come back, and it's right there on Twitter. And if it's been deleted, it's somebody's archived it. And it's going to be out there. So we need to be very aware, you know, of what this ability for us to do the surveillance of others really means. Now, I do want to say it can be a very good thing, right? If we look at the cases of, for example, Philando Castile or Eric Garner or so many other victims of police murder and brutality, we know that having all of that information, the videos and the immediate tweets online, really opened up these stories to the world and let the entire world see what these police officers were doing. And so it's not that it's necessarily a bad thing, as is the case with most technology. It's how it's used that can create danger.
All right, Chris, let's go on to another big technology story. Take us to the next one.
Okay, let's talk about kind of a misleading article, actually, from CNBC, but I think very important to understand. The title with this one was, GPS can track you even when you turn it off. Well, it's not entirely true that GPS can track you when it's off. You know, these are the GPS or location services on your phone. But I think there is an important truth in this story. So even if you turn your smartphone's location services off, you can still be tracked by, first of all, your cell phone provider, and second of all, other software on your phone. So some researchers have been able to track people they did some testing in London and also in and around Boston, Massachusetts. So First of all, our phones have all of these sensors in them. So they can do image stabilization when we take a shaky video. They can be used as a ruler or a level if we're hanging something on our walls, right? And that's really cool, and it's great that we can do that. In order to have that capability in our phones, it has to be able to measure how fast you're going. It has to measure the angle that the phone is at. And so there's all these different sensors that we have in our phones that software on our phones can read, right? They can read the measurements and how that's how they give us some sort of information. Now, if the software is reading this and can tell what your altitude is, how fast you're going, and then can see what Wi-Fi networks are near you, it can actually give a pretty good sense of where you are at that moment, even if your actual GPS service is turned off. So that's what that's the truth that comes out of this CNBC story, even though I think the headline is quite misleading. And I did send it to our friend Steve from Left Eye on the News, and maybe he'll mention it in his show on Friday. So very important to know, even though the headline is wrong, the actual sense in the story here is correct.
Today is Monday. Wall Street Journal has a technology section on Monday. Two of the headlines are third parties know exactly where you are. And then the second headline, phones track step by step, a look at the scenarios in which companies can make use of your whereabouts. That's exactly what we're talking about here, Chris. Again, is there anything that people can do so that our step by step, our actual, ambulatory mobility, whatever you want to call it, transient beings going from one place to another where somebody isn't knowing everything, if they can track us when our phone is off, what do you do?
Short of leaving your phone turned off and at home, unfortunately, there's no foolproof way to guarantee that somebody's not tracking you. So even when your phone is just sitting in your pocket with all of that stuff off, the GPS and location services off, your cell phone provider still knows where you are. And we've talked about this in the past. Your phone has to find the towers around it. And based on that, your phone gets a signal from those towers, and that's how you can make calls and send data. But that also means that your cell phone provider knows exactly where you are. We don't actually know if they're selling that information, but we do know that all of the major cell phone providers cooperate with national security requests from federal agencies. So they will give that information away when requested. One of the things you can do to be a little more secure is don't run apps that you don't trust. Make sure that the app you're running has a good reputation. The developer is somebody that is known. Check the reviews on the app stores for them, if it's the app store from Apple or the Google Play Store. And don't install something just because everyone else has installed it. Just to, check it out yourself, check the reviews. And if it's asking you for permission to use your location or other parts of your phone, really think about whether that app is going to need that stuff. Now, if you've got a fitness tracker, it's probably going to need to know how many steps you're taking and all of that. And that's a personal decision that folks have to make for themselves. But if you're playing a game, it doesn't need to know where you are. It doesn't need to probably use the camera on your phone.
Let me ask you, too, a question about swiping up to shut down an app when you're not using it. Apple made a point of saying in this last release that you no longer need to close apps if you're not using them, that they aren't going to use any more memory or any more battery power than they would if they were shut off. But if we don't shut them off, is that a way for them to track us?
Most of the time, that's actually correct. But an app in the background can request from the phone some time to perform new calculations. So let's say you're uploading a photo and it's taking a while and you switch over to another app. It can actually say, I want to finish uploading this file. Quitting the app entirely can help. However, some apps can register for background notification services. For example, if you use Google Maps and you have you have a route that you're active on, Google will still send you a notification on your phone, even if you're in another app, that it's time to turn right in 200 yards, right? So that's actually running in the background. And the only way to stop that is actually to kill the app by swiping up, as you said.
Okay, I want to go back to this Wall Street Journal article. I want to read a couple sentences to you. And again, this is how wireless carriers get permission to share your whereabouts. industry outsources job of seeking approval to third-party firms. And just stay with me. This will take 30 seconds. But I want the audience to hear it, and I want Chris to address it. Cell phone carriers usually ask for their customers' blessings before listing their phone numbers, sharing their addresses, or exposing them to promotional emails. But seeking permission to share one particularly sensitive piece of information, a cell phone's current location, often falls to one of several dozen third-party companies like Securus Inc. or 3S Interactive Corporation. Carriers such as AT&T and T-Mobile US rely on those firms to vouch that they obtained users' content consent. They vouch that they obtained users' consent before handing over the data. The companies that pay to access this information use it for everything from preventing credit card fraud to providing roadside assistance. That arrangement embarrassed the wireless industry earlier this year after it was discovered that Securus, the third party, a prison phone operator, created a website that let law enforcement agencies find the location of non-inmates without their permission. All four national carriers said in June that they would cut off two companies that handled the data Securus had accessed and promised new safeguards, though they didn't detail how it would be done. And then finally, quote, "This is just the tip of the iceberg," Georgetown law expert Laura Moy testified in a House subcommittee hearing last week on internet privacy. "We're probably just seeing what could be the beginning of a massive investigation and a lot of privacy violations." Mm-hmm. I mean, this is
a big deal.
This is a huge story. I mean, we have hearings going on in Congress about it. That's the tip of the iceberg. And you have this company that's tracking our phone on behalf of AT&T or mobile, not on behalf of, they're being paid. They're mm-hmm. paying them to be able to track. And they're giving the information to law enforcement about non-inmates, which would be like everybody who's not in prison, giving it to law enforcement. Again, there's the Fourth Amendment. The government cannot search and seize our property or us without probable cause. There's no probable cause. There's not even law enforcement. It's law enforcement is being given this data by third-party corporations that pay AT&T and mobile for the right to track us. I mean, it's such a fundamental violation of constitutional rights. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to go back to kind of something from the beginning of that quote where they said it's being used for roadside assistance and things like that. You know, that sounds really helpful, right, for the roadside assistance to know where you are. But I want to know about what the other uses, what other companies are buying this information from Securus and these other firms that I guarantee almost no one has ever heard of. Which advertising companies, which data brokers are buying all this information and consolidating it? And I hope there are hearings that expose this. I think we all have a right to know, and I think your Fourth Amendment concerns are very real, and the law still hasn't really caught up to the technology. It's been behind for a very, very long time. In terms of the police having access to this, I think that's something they've had for a very long time. Whether it's directly through them or just by filing a national security request, we've already known that local police and federal law enforcement agencies get really good cooperation from AT&T.
Let me just jump in though, because there's this. Yes, if they send a national security letter, or if they go to the FISA court, or if they get a warrant, the law enforcement already has access. But we're talking about bulk data that's being provided to law enforcement that doesn't even require them to obtain a warrant. In other words, it gives them complete 100% leeway. They don't even have to go through the pro forma process of a letter or a warrant.
No, you're right. Yeah, they don't even have to pretend. They don't have to go through the process of sending a national security letter or going to the FISA court. And you're absolutely right. In that case, I can't disagree with that. And it is a very scary reality that we need to understand and we need to contend with. Unfortunately, with the semi-monopolies that the phone and internet carriers have at this point, it's very difficult to get away from this.
Let's talk about our new Supreme Court nominee, None other than Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh was the deciding vote, or maybe, I can't remember whether he was the deciding vote or a dissenting vote, with that young teenage girl who was an immigrant, an undocumented person who wanted an abortion, and Kavanaugh said the U.S. government should not allow her to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. And many people thought, well, that's Brett Kavanaugh's auditioning for Donald Trump becoming the Supreme Court nominee, because I don't think he was actually on the short list until that decision was taken. But that aside, and despite all of the objectionable earlier rulings by Brett Kavanaugh, Brett Kavanaugh is also against what is popularly known, but I think badly labeled, net neutrality, which should be called net freedom. Talk about Brett Kavanaugh and his role as the new possible Supreme Court ninth justice.
You know, I'm going to read directly from a dissent that he wrote last year on this issue. The quote, Supreme Court precedent establishes that internet service providers have a First Amendment right to exercise editorial discretion over whether and how to carry internet content. Kavanaugh then goes on to say that the government, quote, may interfere with that right only if it shows that an internet service provider has market power in a relevant geographic market. So he wrote a dissent about supporting net neutrality last year, and he is awful in so many ways. But we've talked before, net neutrality is such an important issue, and you're right, it should be called internet freedom. I think that's much more clear. So the concern here is that Kavanaugh, should net neutrality come to the Supreme Court, Kavanaugh, if he does not recuse himself, and I don't see why he would based on his past behavior, will certainly be a vote against net neutrality, against internet freedom. He pays a little lip service to the idea of monopoly in this concept, but based on other rulings he has made on similar issues, he's not going to actually see monopoly where it really exists. And in many rural areas and even some suburban areas in the country, you know, you have one or maybe two providers that you can choose from to get internet service. Those of us in cities where we have two or three, which is still not a great amount considering they all charge these exorbitant fees, may not realize that, you know, if you're out in the country, you might just have one provider and you get satellite service and you don't have a choice to go somewhere else. And so Kavanaugh is really setting up a precedent here or a platform here for the Supreme Court to actually strike down, finally, deal a blow to internet freedom.
Let's kind of go through the so-called intellectual argument, because it's kind of intellectual gobbledygook. So the providers, the big cable companies or technology companies that can regulate how we access the internet, they have a First Amendment right. They have a First Amendment right to deprive us of our equal access to the internet, and that the only way we can have access to certain places and certain sites is to pay them more. That's what the First Amendment in this case boils down to. Let's pick this apart, because it's such BS, you know, bad sociology. We have a situation where the U.S. government, through the Pentagon, through our tax dollars, created the internet. The internet is then used, and the UN describes access to the internet as a human right. But now these mega monopoly, private profit-making corporations, their right to deprive us of our rights becomes the dominant right, the more important right.
The more important right.
According to Brett Kavanaugh. So if you have this hierarchy of rights, their rights as super corporations making profits, their First Amendment right trumps our First Amendment right, it's not the First Amendment, because the First Amendment only says Congress shall pass no law that, you know, prevents people from exercising their right to speech or the press from operating and saying what the press wants to say. The Congress can pass no law that inhibits or obstructs that. But let's just go through this argument, because it really is, everything's done with a noble cause. This is about, according to Brett Kavanaugh, the defense of the First Amendment, when it is, in fact, the negation of the First Amendment, or that, let's put it more broadly speaking, the negation of our free speech rights, which is the right to go on the internet freely as we've always done up until now.
Yes, and you know, it's also the negation of First Amendment rights for smaller or less popular news outlets. You know, we know that AT&T and Comcast and you know the other major internet providers are also tangled up in, they own or they're owned by or some mix of, you know, media companies. And so the media companies have entertainment networks, they have news networks, and that's what each provider is going to want us to see. They're not going to slow down their affiliated content. They're going to slow down or completely block other content. And so if they don't want us to see Sputnik News online, they're going to be able to block that or slow it down so it seems like there's something wrong with that server. And so that certainly, if we're going to say there's First Amendment rights for the giant companies, what about the First Amendment rights for the small smaller news outlets? I think on top of that, you're absolutely right about it being a First Amendment issue for your average person trying to get news or trying to get entertainment online. We did pay for the internet, and in fact, we pay so much for the upkeep of the actual infrastructure of the internet that it should be, as the UN says, an absolute right for all people, a free and open internet.
Yeah, free and open internet. Again, I'm going to read the First Amendment because people don't know what it says. So for him to cite the First Amendment, again, just it's BS. It's bogus.
Yep.
And again, making it sound like it's about freedom when in fact it's about taking away freedom. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's the First Amendment. It's very clear. The idea that these corporations have a First Amendment right to charge us for access to the internet, which again, really is the public airways, right? I mean, they didn't make it. They didn't create it. They are gatekeepers. And their gate has a very, very heavy toll attached to it. We're already paying $100 a month or $120 a month, right? Like right now in the Washington, D.C. area, this is regarding cable TV, not just internet, but, you know, you can't watch RT anymore. You can't watch CGTN, the Chinese TV. You can't watch some of the international channels. These corporations have been declared by the Supreme Court to be people with the rights of personhood. And now, apparently, when they deprive us of our free speech rights, in a line with Justice Kavanaugh, he says, if we were to be free again on the internet, that would be actually obstructing, inhibiting their free speech rights to deprive us of our freedom. Anyway, Chris, we have 30, 40 seconds left. Take us out.
All right, real quick, two things. The tech tip for this week is to, you know, everyone gets those update notifications, right? Hey, a new version of your software is available. Yep. And most people ignore them, but it's very important to actually go through and run those updates. There are security updates, there are feature updates, there are stability updates that you're going to get on your computer or phone through those. So unless you have a good reason not to that you know, go ahead, take the time and run those updates. Real quick, I just want to let people know if any of our listeners are going to be at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference in New York City this weekend. I'm going to be there. I would love to meet folks, and there's going to be a lot of interesting stuff we can talk about from there next week.
All right. That's great. Chris Garafa is our guest, as he is every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. Chris talked to us from New Haven, Connecticut. If you want to find him at that convention, maybe send him a message on
Facebook,
on one of the social media platforms.
Sure.
Absolutely. All right, John, that's all the time we have for right now. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.